Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today's special guest is Denny Setiawan, who's a UX product coach, designer, and anything around that with a huge list of credentials. And today we'll be tackling the UX approach for startups, especially funded startups. Hi, Denny. Thrilled to have you here today.
Hi, Jane. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I came across your profile and your amazing answers on Quora. You're absolutely the king of Quora, answering all kinds of startup questions. Please tell us your story, how you ended up being a UX coach for startups.
Sure. So I've been in the corporate world for a while. So I work for big brands like Yahoo and then Economist. And recently I started helping out with an accelerator here called Startup Accelerator. It's basically an accelerator based in New York City that's helping startup from Eastern Europe to break into the US market. Working with those founders helped me to see that, oh, actually this is a lot of fun to actually get to see the result, and the startup world moving fast is actually the kind of thing that really drives me to see the result. So that's how I got into that, and then I figured that, okay, maybe I could lend some help to people who are struggling also but don't know where to go, and Quora is the first place that I went to.
Great. So what exactly are you working on these days? You work at The Economist, from what I know, right? So what do you do there, and how do you combine that with consulting work?
So I do a few things. So The Economist is the main thing now. So I'm leading a team here. We're responsible for all the user experience for all the mobile devices. So if you use The Economist on Android, on iPhone, the user experience owned by us. So that's that. And the main thing here, the really interesting challenge that we've been working on is really to bring in that startup mentality, the lean startup methodology here, so the innovation can move faster. Because if you think about it, even for a really mature company like The Economist, we need to innovate, especially in the publishing world these days, right? And in order to innovate, then we need to put together a system of learning, and we need to learn fast and cheaply. And this is like what startups are really good at. And we're basically like a growth stage startup again. We need to identify the customer segment again. We need to identify the problem again so that we can keep re-engaging a new customer, finding new opportunity to generate revenue. So that's the main thing. And then also I'm about to start teaching at General Assembly, UX class, part-time UX class coming up this Saturday. This is basically my way of staying in touch with what's going on in the market in terms of the skill level and what's really needed from the supply side, the designers, and also educating them. So I finished one last year, and it was also very rewarding for me because I discovered that I love teaching. So that was the second thing. And the third thing is just like what I told you, mentoring startups here and there for two purposes. The first one is just to get to the product market fit, the early stage, when they're like, oh, we got an awesome product. And the question, of course, always like, do you actually have a problem to solve, right? And if you do, then do you know where to find these people who have the problem? So these are the kind of things that I help them with. And then also the second bit is for the growth stage startup, when they also already got the product market fit, they got traction, they're like, okay, yeah, now we can grow, we can actually own this market. But up to that point, as you know, Jane, a lot of times the UX is pretty hacky to get to that point.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Right? Because it's all just the MVP. It's all just about like to prove that value, that traction. Now they're growing the team like threefold. Like they're hiring like crazy, and quality will go down. And with that, usability issue will creep in. User experience quality could go down. So I'm helping them create the culture of showing the value, and also making sure that we watch things like the system usability test to measure the customer satisfaction from a usability standpoint and things like that, so they can grow.
Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of things I'd love to ask you about.
Sure.
And one of them is that you have a huge experience about leading teams, UX teams in particular.
Yep.
But I'd love to hear what kind of activities that translate into, and how you can lead a team, let's say remotely or on spot, how do you get together? How do you translate those values, and how do you, you know, manage and educate the people?
Well, the big thing that I've been seeing is that a lot of UX designers are focused on deliverables, and they don't. That's why there's a disconnect between the UX team and the product and the rest of the company. So the first thing that I normally try to instill in my team is really to understand the business, where they come from. So we joke around internally here at The Economist that, oh, make sure that UX that person. You know, you apply your UX skill as in like user research and understanding their pain points, understanding their journey and that. And they here is like the stakeholder. For example, somebody from marketing, somebody from development. What are the pain points? What are they trying to achieve? What's their user flow, if you will?
Mm-hmm. And what kind of group building activities do you engage into?
We do a lot of co-creation. That's the best way to actually get buy-in. So, for example, we do proto-persona exercise. So this is basically getting everybody to tell us what they know about our users, put it in a sketchy way, you know, just draw it on a whiteboard or like on papers, so that everybody's on the same page in terms of who we're targeting and whatnot. So that kind of thing is good. And then we validate with real users, right? Another one would be like storyboarding so that we understand, okay, what are the limitations? What are the scenarios that are important for our users? Is this realistic? For example, with The Economist app, we thought that, oh, people definitely read our stuff during their commute. But then as we storyboarded, we discovered that actually that's not really realistic. And then because, you know, especially in New York, you don't have much space. When you're in, you know, in rush hour, in the train, how can you read The Economist? So in this sense, then we discovered that audio is actually why, you know, the better medium for them to enjoy the content. And that actually led us to investigate the data and talk to people more. And it was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And this kind of validation in reality, that based on reality, actually charge the team, not just the UX team, but bring the team, the product team together.
Mm-hmm. Are you working with the whole team, or is it just a number of designers and UX specialists that you're working with?
So that's an interesting question, because the way we see teams now is becoming more and more fluid. So in The Economist and the other companies, normally UX is part of the product team, right? Cross-functional. This is why it's more important for UX designers to be generalists, to be able to support from end-to-end, from user research, interaction design, visual design, prototyping, the whole thing. So we work, I have my team as in like designers who work as part of the function of UX function, but also we are part of the product team.
Mm-hmm. So it's essentially coaching a product team to be UX specialists.
Correct. So the long-term goal here is really to instill the user-centered design culture for the entire product organization so that everybody think about the user, right? Because if you read all these, the Lean or all the startup world these days, the books, they talk about the first thing you need to do is talking to the users. That's what all the founders need to do. They need to understand the pain points. They need to talk a lot with them. And all these things are, a lot of these are functions that UX people do, and we can help the product team to do this better by coaching them.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how you instill that feeling of lean UX, you know, mode into a big company that has like old systems all around the place.
Yep, that is a big challenge.
It is a huge challenge. I hear all around, I mean, I get a lot of feedback via email, and the most common problem is like, how do your practices are great, but how do I instill them in the huge organizations where the distance between, you know, management and the final user is like 20 people? Like, what do you do?
So the main thing here is that the reason why it's so hard to make lean and agile, this kind of practice, work in the big corporations is because there's already a culture there, right? And a culture includes the processes that's there, which is basically just the way people do things based on what they believe works and what is valuable for them. For example, usability test, right? An easy one. In a lot of big companies, when they're new to this and you propose usability test, they'll be like, no. A lot of people said, no, this is too expensive. It takes too much time, all that, right? But then like once you started doing that and they realized, oh, it's actually not bad. Now there are so many tools these days like Usability Hub, usertesting.com for the remote stuff that you can start doing these things in a smaller scale. That's also another lean thing, small batch. So you can get small wins and to get people to see that, oh, actually, this is useful for me. That's always the first aha moment is when developers, the product people see a recording and they're like, oh, they don't know how to use our stuff. Damn, we've been building it this way all these times and they don't know how to, oh, we should just like change this really quickly. And then after they change it, what do they want to see? They want to see if it works, right? So the key here is that don't try to, it can be really intimidating, but try with small wins. But when they get the value, start getting the value, and for example, the product manager get the value in that, oh, this is what the improvement is, and then he can have a narrative now that he can sell to his boss, right? And then the boss gets a new narrative to sell to his boss.
All right, so the recipe for success in such case, if there is, let's say, UX specialist or a developer who is all about startup methodology, if they want to conquer their, you know, bosses, they have to build success stories so those can pass them over to their bosses so that the management gets the UX, you know, success spirit instilled, right?
Yeah. Yep, so right? Two things there. One is the narrative, like you said, give them a narrative. Give mm-hmm. them a story to tell their boss, their whatever, when they go to conference, whatever, right? So that they can actually get something out of it. And mm-hmm. the second bit is make them really involved. And instead of just giving them, okay, this is what we did, get them involved and don't alienate them. And one of the big mistakes that a lot of UX professionals do these days is they try to make themselves sound important and make things sound really complicated. And that alienates people. And by using the word, the terms like, hey, let's do affinity mapping exercise. You know, like, why do that? Let's do like some sticky exercise, you know, like use post-its workshop, you know, something that people don't feel like, oh, that's just that a simple thing. So they can be part of it. And that way they will support you more. And they're like, oh, this is also part of my story. And they become part of your tribe, if you will. So they start adopting your culture.
Mm-hmm. This is my first favorite recipe. I didn't quite guess about the narratives, but I definitely know that people do value things that they get involved into mm-hmm. and that they invest their own effort into. So if you get everyone in the company to get invested into the UX, they will be your natural advocates.
Definitely.
That's great. These are just two awesome pieces of advice. So give them a narrative and make them involved by participating in simple UX activities.
Yep.
Super useful. So are there any stories or like most successful and exciting anecdotes and narratives that you've been sharing around?
Well, I think the biggest one is at The Economist. Here, when we started doing this whole user-centered design, people are like, what? We know who we're selling to. We know our customer. We've been doing this for over 100 years. But then like we did the agile transformation, so the software development process is already pretty good. But we have to redo a lot of things, a lot of them, because we get customer support issues. We got some bad reviews. And that's when I joined in and we started figuring out, okay, maybe we should put in a little bit more time in understanding what they do and see. And it's really cool to start seeing how even that we have like a separate visual design or department, if you will, who are like mm-hmm. used to doing the print and all that, the old ways, right? So this is one of my favorite stories. So we try to engage them to be part of this so that they can also support us, right? And they were like, oh, here's the design. And done, right? Because they acted like almost like an agency. And we're like, oh, this is not going to work. But how do we get them to actually support us? So we use Usability Hub to test the reaction from users. And we got that, and then we tried to do it the first time around. We use something that's safe, meaning that we know it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So we showed them, and they're like, yep, we know what we're doing. That way, the second time around, or the third, I forgot when, we were not sure, and we're like, oh, this is not going to work. They already bought into the method. So when the result came back not as positive for them, they were open to changing because they already bought into that. So that was like, oh, yeah, this process works.
Yeah, this is a really story, a good story about engaging old style design teams, as there are plenty of these around us these days. So my next question would be about early stage startups, those that are just validating their product market fit.
Yeah.
What would be top UX activities that they can do, and whether that be like UX research or actual design process?
If they already figure out the problem solution fit, meaning that the problem definitely is a pain point for their target customers, and they're trying to just they're trying to figure out if the market is there, which is the product market fit, then I think the best thing to do is really optimizing their marketing effort, in this case the landing page, and maybe like the experience between their growth channels to their the growth channels that they're planning to use. For example, if they're going to use Facebook ad, they're experimenting with that in a small scale, make sure that that channel works with the landing page, and then figure out what the landing page optimization looks like. And then for that, from that, if they see the product market fit, the market is big enough, then they can start designing. But the design in this case should focus on really communicating what the value is, the problem is, and how do they make that resonate with their users. So that's what they need to be validating.
Mm-hmm. So they need to make sure they're capable of making the sales happen based on their pain point and the market.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But what about web app internals? So those users, those early adopters that they're working with, does it really matter what kind of product they will see when they log into the web app they just purchased?
Well, that part is definitely important, right? But then, like, if the focus there again is going back to the value. So There is this one, I'm not gonna mention the name, but there's this one app that we use to do session recording, and it works great for the main feature, but the rest is buggy as hell. But we're happy. But we're happy because the main feature that we're paying for is working, and we understand that. This is still early stage, and we're happy to be part of it. And that's the thing with early adopters. They're more tolerant, if you will. And of course, they're your most important advocate, so you need to engage them. So if anything else, get them to help you to figure out how you can actually make the product more robust.
Mm-hmm. So those people who you're dealing with are loyal and actually... visual polish doesn't matter that much at this stage.
In terms of visual, it really depends on what you're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you do want to make sure that they have faith in your product, because that's what visual polish actually communicates. It's like, oh, this is professional, this is credible. So as long as you have that in their minds, then you're good. Don't worry about too much about like making sure the gradient is just right. It's the shiny thing. Don't worry about those things. The main thing is just, what are you communicating in their mind, the impression that they got? Is this, at the end of the day, what you want them to do, the behavior that you want, is for them to keep coming back and keep giving you money. As simple as that, right? And in order to do that, they need to trust your brand, trust your product. And that's what your visual design needs to do.
Exactly. From your experience, I know that bootstrapped companies can be as self-funded as bootstrapped as possible in the beginning of the spectrum. Oh, what kind of, how well-funded, or let's say how well-prepared are people to invest into the design when in the early stages? What kind of approach do most people take? Not from the theory, but from the companies that you've worked with, early stage startups.
From what I've seen, a lot of companies actually, to be honest with you, over invested into the UI, into the visual design in the beginning.
Seriously, over-invested?
Yeah, because...
That's amazing.
They cared because it's more fun to actually design and work on the visual side of things, make it look sexy. But the UX part of things hasn't been figured out properly.
Okay, meaning the UX.
Mm-hmm. The UX side of, as in like, is this the user flow? Is this really a problem? I found like many, many companies already have like a really polished looking app, even a build, right? But they still don't know if their problem is real, if people are willing to pay money for it. So they already spend a lot of money, sometimes bootstrap, sometimes somebody else's money, but still it's their runway, right? So they already spend that on like making it this polished visual thing, and it is important to sell, but you need to find that balance and just enough so that one, that again, the landing page, you can communicate the value, the pain point, and it also give, and of course the more important thing is so you can test it to get the reaction from your users. So it needs to be polished to that point, but no more.
Mm-hmm. How open, what's your opinion about using themes on the early stage?
Yeah, you should do it. Just use UI kits and themes.
Mm-hmm. That's my favorite one, but I was wondering whether it's the same on all sides of the world, you know?
Well, there are a lot of people who spend too much time and money in the early stage and branding. This is also another point of over-designing. The branding, mm-hmm. like they spend thousands of dollars getting a logo done, for example, and then all this letterhead and whatnot, and have their shiny business card that say CEO, founder, president, chairman. Who cares if you don't make money? So at that point, the main thing is make your product work, address real problem, identify the market, and then you can, once you have the traction and you need to get to talk to like the business, the big guys to for business development. For example, now you need to make a business deal with Viacom or with, you know, like BBC. Yeah, then you need the proper branding. That's when you invest in that.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's great advice, definitely. But when you're dealing with people, I imagine there is like a huge variety of different teams and founders. And some of them, I mean, everybody values design and UX like declaratively. But in fact, they have all different attitudes towards UX practices and actual activities. How do you sell your ideas and your services to founders that are not that keen on spending their resources and time on UX? Not visual design, but actual, you know, UX and functionality of the app.
Mm-hmm. So the question here is really, how do you sell the value of UX to these business people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they come to you and they're like, oh yeah, we love UX, we need that. But then in reality, they don't really have the budget set aside for it because they still think that it's a nice to have. But in reality, that's really important for their core, the core product. So the way you go about that is to engage them in their own world by asking questions. You know, what we do best as user experience people, right? User research. Ask them questions about their pain points. And then mm-hmm. as they talk about it, oh yeah, we need to, from the product standpoint, it's about, you know, retention right now. You know, we're losing customer. And then you can also go deeper asking, okay, so what's the business model? So engage them in their own world, right? So if the business model is a subscription, every customer costs this much. For example, if it's a B2B and each customer is paying $15,000 per year, which is not much, pretty common, then paying a UX person, let's say $3,000 to do an audit and fix that, already paid off, right? With one mm-hmm. customer only, just retain one customer, already paid off more than the amount that they pay you. Don't sell them on deliverables. Don't sell them on, like, oh, I'm going to do user flow, I'm going to do persona. They don't care about those. They care about the result, the ROI. That's the focus.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to larger startups that got their seed round of funding, let's say. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that they're building larger teams, focusing on growth. They already got their product market fit. What kind of coaching and UX activities could you conduct with them?
The first thing is to make sure that they know where they're at right now, right? So they have the product market fit. So the first thing is identifying the current state of the customer journey and the user experience. So we can easily do a survey and user interview, look at customer service feedback, app reviews, those kind of things. So basically the first thing is to get the baseline of where you're at right now, so that when you're growing your team, growing your practice, growing your product, you can continue measuring that and make sure that it doesn't drop. And even better, if you can improve that. So I'll continue. Mm-hmm. So start with something like a survey, and I suggest doing that regularly, like every month, every quarter, whatever that is. SUS is a good one for this, system usability scale kind of survey that's standard for the industry. And another thing is that after you figure that out, you figure out this is good, then do usability tests, right? After you do your heuristics and figure out, okay, potentially there are these things that could be problematic for our users. Then just quickly do a remote usability test, usertesting.com kind of thing, set up few tasks, core tasks that are really important for your product, the core things that they need to do. Get the test running so you can get, again, to see, okay, where are we right now? And as you improve the product, as you add more features, keep running those things. So mm-hmm. you know that you're protecting the main, the core tasks. You keep protecting those. And then as you build things, then make sure they support the core tasks. So the key is to make sure that the people who are already there, the early adopters we talked about earlier, and people who are already your customers, are happy and become even happier, right, with the new features, with all these. And that's how you actually grow the team. And in terms of the team themselves, they need to also understand the way you measure things, as it's not just deliverable.
Mm-hmm. As a coach, as an external consultant, what's your level of involvement in these activities? Do you just get together, let's say, every week or every month with your clients and recommend them do this and do that? Or do you just get hands-on on all these activities?
It really depends on, it's going back to your question earlier about the amount of investment they want to make, how fast mm-hmm. they want to go, right? So
exactly.
It varies from just like starting with a workshop and then continuing with calls here and there. And then when there's a big need, then I come back again for a workshop to like few days workshop. But in most cases, it starts slow until they get to the point where they feel like, oh, now we have a momentum. We really want to move fast. This UX thing is really a strategic thing that we need to invest more in. That's when things get faster, and that's when like we do like more workshops in-house, a couple days, and then after that follow up the next week, and then the week after.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but it varies. That's the short answer.
Right. What would be your top recommendations for startups who are looking to hire someone, you know, to improve their user experience, be it a band of designers or an external consultant, depending on their budget, what would be your recommendation for the startups?
I would say it depends on the stage again, but mm-hmm. the first thing that I would recommend is really get somebody who is a generalist, meaning that somebody who can do everything from user research to rapid prototyping to visual design, all these. They don't have to be expert, of course, but they can actually support your product from end to end. So that's the first thing. You don't need people with tons of experience. Just make sure you get somebody who's hungry enough to learn about, because that's a key point in our field, right? As a user experience professionals, we need to be curious. We need to be hungry. We need to want to learn. Those are the two things that are important. And then once, if you're in a growth stage and you need somebody more experienced to put into practice, then get those generalists to support the product teams, and then get somebody who is more experienced to actually lead them, to give mm-hmm. them the strategic directions and give them the framework to work with.
Mm-hmm. Across your experience, do you mostly see remote teams or on-site work?
Mostly small on-site supplemented with freelancers that come here and there, or sometimes with consultants.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now I'd like to go to your roots more and your backstory. And I'd like to ask you how you actually arrived at this kind of expertise and what kind of mistakes or actually wins occurred on your way to success.
Sure. Originally, I always wanted to be a painter or be an artist.
Oh.
And I got into the whole... I came here to the States. I'm originally from Indonesia. I came here to the States for college, and I figured that, you know, being a painter is probably a really rough life for me. So I decided to do something more commercial, which is graphic design. And after I got my degree, the dot-com was really big, was booming. So I got into the whole web design, and I was really intrigued by the whole interaction side of things. In my mind at the time, there was this thing called Flash.
Oh yes, there was one.
So I was intrigued by Flash, and I was like, wow, I can make my design interactive, come to life, you know. So that's how I got into it. And also HTML allowed me to do a little bit of that, but Flash was more interesting for me. Then I got my master's here in New York from Parsons in multimedia.
Serious. Sure.
Yep.
Sorry.
So that was
your no small feat at all.
Yeah, it was two years of hell.
Seriously, tell us more about it.
Because it was at the time everybody was trying to figure out what this whole multimedia is about. We're still doing that right now on a different level. But at the time with this whole web, it was really interesting time. But the big challenge was, how do you actually commercialize this other than e-commerce? So that was the interesting time for me to also learn about. At the time, even my colleagues, my friend from the school did things with Internet of Things. With all these things that we're seeing today, they already started doing it back then, but there was no application. So my struggle back then was like, okay, so all these things are cool, the possibilities are endless, but how do I make money? So going back to that. So how do I actually support a living, right? So after that, I was fortunate to get a job at this company, a small startup, if you will, that does affiliate network marketing. And I was the creative director for that company. But that was just a hefty title for somebody who's responsible for two people doing banner ads and newsletters and some websites to get the banner codes. Our work was really good, though, and our clients actually love us, and we got spun off into a separate company that's just basically an agency, creative agency. And we grew to 17 people in like
a
year.
Did you say 70? 70?
No, 17.
Okay, and that's not that bad then.
I wish.
Still
70.
A large team, yes.
Yeah, within a year we grew that fast. And in the end we were doing things like, the main thing that we did was PowerPoint templates. Apparently there's a lot of money to be made for that, because like salespeople are willing to pay good money for really appealing design, because they can actually make money off it, right? They can close the deal. And after a while, I created the system. That's how I got into the whole UX, actually. I didn't know about it back then, but I was designing the system with the flow, who are the, you know, identifying who the users were, what were they trying to accomplish, all these things that I know, that's what those were. I was just doing it because I needed to solve this problem, because we have like the researcher, designer, the client, the accounting person, all trying to get this workflow working together, and it was all manual. So I created this, I designed it, they build it, it's an interface where everybody goes to the same place and do their thing. After that was done, and it was like cranking up this PowerPoints and other deliverables 24/7, I got bored. And Yahoo Finance knocked on my door, and at the time I was dating a broker, a stock broker. So I'm like, oh, this is interesting. So I went there. So I went to Yahoo, and that's when I was really introduced to this whole agile and UX. So I was hired because I have the visual and interaction and also the prototyping skills. So they combined that. I'm like, oh, this is cool. And after a couple of years, Yahoo were kind of like going down-ish, as you know, the rest is history. So, and I wanted to come back to New York, so The Economist came to me. So I came here, And I started out helping with the web guidelines as, again, a hybrid of interaction and visual designer. And I'm still here, but like 6 years ago. And things that really interesting to me here is like, is that what we do really, really impact a lot of people, and they're really passionate about what we create. And, you know, they're proud of it. It's so crazy how when we get users to come in, they would like talk for 5 to 10 minutes just about how they love The Economist. So I'm like, okay, I guess we're doing something good. So that's where I am now.
And absolutely, you know, publishing is a super competitive and tough industry. And yourself staying there for 6 months or 6 years definitely means that it's a very rewarding environment for you to flourish as a professional.
It's very challenging. Because as you just mentioned, the publishing industry is going through a big change, obviously.
Could you comment on that a little more?
Well, as you know, right? People used to buy magazines, subscribe to magazines, the hard copy. These days, content is becoming more a commodity. Now you can access content through Apple News, through Google, whatever they call it, Google Now, I think, and Twitter, Facebook, and Google also started doing things where you can post content directly to Google, so you don't have to have a website anymore. And then there's tons of competition, like even marketing, right? Content marketing is the big thing now. Really good content. And for the users, the readers, it's all just content at the end of the day. Back in the day, it was hard to find good content. That's why like the brand and then the subscription, there's still value in that, but the model is changing very fast. So this is why user experience is very, very important. Right? So we need to make sure that they have something unique that they experience with a certain brand so they come back for more. So that's the challenge that's interesting for me, is that how do we actually redefine what we're offering. So we have really, really good core product, which is the content. Of course, the content is appealing, it's witty, it's strong, people love it. But there's also a big barrier of entry, meaning that it requires quite a bit of effort to actually get to the value of it, especially for new users, new customers. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we actually change that and make it easier for them and make it sticky? But sticky not in the in a bad way, meaning that, you know, we trick them with all these like crazy gamification things. If it works, but then at the end of the day, it just needs to be sticky because it gives them value and they want more of it that actually improve their lives.
Yeah. Could you share a couple most successful introductions or wins that you introduced personally while being there?
The big ones was probably when we did the mobile web.
Mm-hmm. was, so you were the one starting it, right?
Yep. So back then we had the desktop. It's all about desktop. And then all of a sudden this whole thing of mobile first, responsive. I'm like, oh, what's going on?
Whoa.
Right? So we got like good traffic on the website. And then when we see like on the mobile, it's like really, really bad. The bounce rate was almost 100%. And because we didn't have any mobile presence. I mean, we didn't have any mobile product. It was just the desktop version of the website loaded on your mobile. So you have to do a lot of pinch and zoom and swipe and scrolling like crazy. So we were supposed to do that in a year. And we were able to finish it on time, which is like a huge feat for us. And we were able to get to the place where it's actually delivering subscription to the business and also, of course, the value for the user. Now the traffic is significant. It's a good portion. I don't remember the percentage, but I'm pretty sure that it's comparable to other publishers.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, that was basically leaving money on the table and pissing off our customers.
Right. So going back to The Economist being your own working and learning environment, that mm-hmm. kind of challenge definitely keeps you hungry, as you said, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And any other comments? So it's been great working there, and you plan to develop further winning features there.
Yep. So the next bit is, again, going back to the culture. What I believe is that it goes from people, processes, and then product. So start with the people. That's why the culture is super important. And as part of the people is their habits, the way they work, what they value, and that is the process. Right? Process is basically just habits because it's automated. We know that we have this need, we want that result, and this is the way we're going to do it. And we're going to repeat it because it worked last time. That's what it is. So people, processes, and then out of that, well, I believe that over time, the product will come, the good quality product, and we can actually do it faster and better. So that's the thing I'm trying to build here.
That's a grand vision.
Yep.
Right. So before we close up shop for today, what would be your top advice for those businesses that want to improve their user experience? One do and one don't?
I guess the do is do your due diligence and really see for yourself what it can do for you, right? So what it can do for your bottom line. So that way you see it for yourself and you can justify it without having to borrow somebody else's argument. Because if you believe it, then you'll fight hard for it. And the second bit, the don't, is that don't discount what user experience, usability can do. So it's kind of like on the same thing, but on the flip side. Don't just see it as a deliverable thing. It can do a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm. My previous guest today said, please stop overemphasizing the value of visual design. And you're saying exactly the same thing just about UX. That means we're onto something here, right?
Well, that's the thing, right? That's another shift that's happening right now in a big way in the industry, is that people used to equate design with visual design, with the UI, with the visual side of things. But design is about giving purpose to something. It's bigger than that. So it can actually deliver a lot more. It's not just a paint job.
Absolutely. So true. So Danny, thank you so much for sharing your advice today. What would be the best place for people to find you online?
I think Twitter is one, and of course, Quora. And I'm also on LinkedIn. So all those places could be good.
Your website, is it your actual presence or not so much?
Yeah, I got some things there. Oh, actually, this could be something interesting for people who are in the business. From the business side. I created this tool recently to help people in the agile world, particularly Scrum Master, Product Manager, to prioritize their backlog based on ROI, including the UX standpoint. Meaning that start with the metrics, and then how many users affected, how often, and then the cost. Because a lot of times when we prioritize here, it's based on the cost only, what's easy, what's fast. Mm-hmm. So that's part, and I mentioned that because it's on my website, dsatia.com.
Okay, how is the tool called? It sounds really great.
It's seems called a relative ROI calculator.
Oh, cool.
So you can also Google that, and hopefully it will lead to my thing. It's a really easy tool to use, hopefully, because that's important. And it's just giving you a number, one number, so you can compare it. And then you can export the Excel document off the table, so you can bring it to Jira or version on whatever tool that you use for your implementation.
Yeah, that sounds great. Sounds like a nice tool. I feel there is really... Everybody has a hard time, linking ROI to actual design improvements, and I think you've done exactly that.
Well, hopefully that's what it does, and I look forward to hearing feedback. I definitely welcome it, and yeah, look forward to hearing you guys.
Thank you for joining us today, Danny, and have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Thanks for having me, Jay.